is the duty of leaders to lead, of the creative to create, of the daring to do. The free world expects leadership of us. Its fate and our fate depends upon our leadership. We are industrious, inventive, restless, with the fires that burn within us. But I say that nothing is easy, and the best things are the hardest. And all our troubles, all our immense difficulties, now and in the future, can I say, be solved if we have the will, the courage.
I'm really excited to talk about this area of healthcare that we just don't touch on enough, and that's preventative care and wellness and how to keep people healthy rather than just treating the sick. So maybe you could just kick off, Dean, by kind of giving us a few minutes of background into what you're doing and some of the results that you found.
Sure. I think the most exciting trend that's happening in medicine today in healthcare is what's called lifestyle medicine, and it's lifestyle, as Christina said, to help prevent disease, but also to help treat it, either in combination with drugs and surgery, or often as a direct alternative to them. And in the almost 40 years of research, we've done a series of studies showing that these simple lifestyle changes, you know, a whole foods plant-based diet, moderate exercise, various yoga and meditation techniques, and perhaps most important, love and support, can not only help prevent, but even reverse. We found first that even severe heart disease could be reversed. It was thought at the time that at best you could slow the rate at which you got worse. We found we could actually get reversal and how quickly these changes can occur, within days to weeks, not just years. We found that not only can heart disease be reversed, type 2 diabetes can be reversed, early stage prostate cancer, by extension breast cancer, that when you change your diet and lifestyle, it actually changes your genes, over 500 genes in just 3 months, turning on the good genes that protect us, turning off the good genes, that particularly the oncogenes that cause prostate, breast, and colon cancer, and even lengthen telomeres, the ends of our chromosomes, to control aging. We can actually begin to reverse the aging process. A study we did with Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, who got the Nobel Prize a few years ago for her work in this area. And having seen what a powerful difference these changes can make, I ended up on a 16-year journey to get Medicare to cover our program, which we can talk about, and to create a new healthcare as opposed to sick care system. So Medicare will now cover our reversing heart disease program, and now that Medicare is paying for it, most of the major insurers are. So we're training and trying to create a new paradigm of healthcare that empowers people with information they can use, whether it's through digital or in person, or in our case, both, to transform their lives for the better.
I definitely want to get back to this question of who's going to pay. But before we get into that, I just wanted to see a show of hands from the audience. Who here has had a conversation with their doctor about nutrition? Okay, so that's about six people out of the whole room.
That's more than usual, by the way.
Yeah, which is an astonishingly high number. So can we talk a little bit about that? Like, why is it that, you know, you said lifestyle is reversing aging and changing our genes. Why is it that our doctors don't know a thing about nutrition and exercise and so on?
Well, unfortunately, we doctors do what we get trained to do, and we get trained to do what we get paid to do. And I used to think if we just did good science, that would change medical practice. And to some degree, it did. But the painful lesson is if it's not reimbursable, it's not sustainable. And that's why I spent 16 years to get Medicare to pay for it. And now that it is, nutrition is becoming more important to doctors. And I think as we move into this era of Obamacare, whatever you think about it, it's really turning all the incentives on their ear. You know, in a fee-for-service environment, the more operations you do, the more drugs you prescribe, the more hospitalizations you have, the more revenue you generate. But in Obamacare, these bundle payments, it's like, here's X amount of dollars to take care of somebody. You, the doctor, or the hospital, or the clinic gets to keep what's left over. So the economics get switched to finding ways to keep people healthy and to find less expensive interventions. And this is happening at a time when all the forces are finally converging to make this the right idea at the right time. At the same time that the randomized trials are showing that drugs and surgery for treating chronic disease don't work nearly as well as people once thought, for example, 8 randomized trials showing that in stable patients, angioplasties and stents and bypass surgery really don't work very well. They don't prolong life. They don't prevent heart attacks. And we spent almost $100 billion last year just in the U.S. on these two operations, angioplasties and bypasses, that are dangerous, invasive, expensive, and largely ineffective. Treating diabetes with drugs, 2 major studies, the Navigator and the Accord studies, showed that it actually increased premature death and didn't decrease the horrible complications of diabetes. And already, by the way, half of Americans are diabetic or pre-diabetic today. And yet getting your blood sugar down with lifestyle, you can prevent all of these horrible things. With prostate cancer, one out of 49 men who's treated for prostate cancer with surgery or radiation lives longer. The other 48 get maimed in the most personal ways. They're incontinent, so they're wearing a diaper. They're impotent, they can't have sex for no benefit at huge economic costs. And yet we found that these same lifestyle changes can not only prevent but reverse prostate cancer as well. And so at the same time that the limitations of high-tech medicine are becoming clearer and the costs are unsustainable, the power of these very simple and low-tech and low-cost interventions is becoming clearer. And last thing is that it's not like there was one, with all this interest in personalization and so on, it wasn't like there was one set of diet and lifestyle recommendations for reversing heart disease and a different one for cancer or your genes or your telomeres. It was the same for all of them. And the more you change, the more you improve at any age.
Yeah, this reminds me of some interesting data I was looking at yesterday from Oscar Health, a company that some of you may know. And they released data from last year in which they showed that 200 patients of I think 40,000 were incurring 50% of their costs.
Yes.
And those were the patients with the chronic diseases.
It's not surprising. We did a study with Mutual of Omaha where, you know, one of the issues with insurance companies was like, why should we spend our money today for some future benefit that chances are someone else is going to get? And I'd say, well, that's because it's the right thing to do. And they'd kind of laugh. So I said, okay. So it turned out that we did two demonstration projects, one with Mutual of Omaha, where they found they saved $30,000 per patient in the first year when people made these lifestyle changes. And another one was with Highmark Blue Cross Blue Shield and found that they cut their overall healthcare costs in half in the first year. And when they looked at the subset of patients that you're referring to that they'd spent at least $25,000 on in the previous year, they reduced their costs by 400% in the next year. So these underlying biological mechanisms are so dynamic, they're both medically effective and cost effective. You can show, we showed a 91% reduction in the frequency of angina or chest pain in the first 2 or 3 weeks. But you can show reductions in healthcare costs, you can cut them in half in the first year. You don't have to wait that long to see the benefits.
Given all of these benefits that you mentioned and just the high costs of caring for these chronically ill patients, why did it take 16 years for you to convince Medicare and some of these other big insurers that what you were doing was worth covering?
Well, it's even worse than that because I've been one of Bill Clinton's doctors since 1993 when Hillary asked me to train the White House chefs and then the Camp David chefs, the Air Force One chefs. I began working with them on their own health issues back in 93. And then when we tried to get Medicare coverage, I had dinner with him. He said, yeah, I'll support this. And I thought, well, you know, he's the President of the United States and he's the head of the executive branch. He'll pick up the phone and he'll tell him to cover it and that'll be the end of it. And 16 years later, we got coverage. And Newt Gingrich, who was Speaker of the House at the time, we were working with some of his family members and he was very, so we had the President of the United States, the Speaker of the House, opposing political parties, 20 members of the Senate, 30 members of the House, heads of the major organizations like the AARP and American Board of Internal Medicine, and on and on and on, and it still took us 16 years. And yet, when I talked to someone recently who has a lot of experience working with Medicare, they said, only 16 years? You know, it's unfortunate that trying to do things that are innovative can often be really challenging, that dealing with these large governmental bureaucracies can be, their attitude was like, presidents come and go, members of Congress come and go, we'll still be here, we'll outlast you. They don't like fundamental change. Incremental change, yes, but fundamental change, no. So, but it was worth it because if you really want to get sustainable changes, you have to change reimbursement. Now that Medicare is paying for it, most of the other large insurance companies are. And then if we change reimbursement, we change not only medical practice, but as you were talking about earlier, medical education as well.
I have to know, how did you kick Bill Clinton's butt and get him into shape?
Well, you can't kick anyone's butt if they're President of the United States. But 5 years ago, when his bypass was clogged up, his cardiologist held a press conference and said, oh, it was all in his genes and his diet and lifestyle had nothing to do with it. And I, of course, knew better. So I sent him an email and I said, the friends that I value the most are the ones who tell me what I need to hear, not just what I want to hear. And you need to know it's not all in your genes. And I say that not to blame, but to empower. Because if it's all in your genes, then what can you do, right? You're just a victim and you're not a victim. You're one of the most powerful guys on the planet. And so I figured either I'll never hear from him again or maybe I will. So a few days later, he reached out, we met, and he went on, and he's been following a plant-based diet now for over 5 years. And I think whatever your politics, I think that's really inspiring, especially someone who was known for eating so unhealthily before. It's like, if he can do it, maybe I can do it too. And he's doing really well.
So he's a vegan now?
He's almost a vegan. He has fish once a week, but other than that, he's been pretty close to being vegan.
Wow. And speaking of this, I mean, there are, it seems like every week, I'm always following sort of the nutrition beat and lifestyle, and I'm seeing a different set of recommendations for how we should be eating. And, you know, even last week, another new set. So how, you know, do we even know how to sort of separate between them? And what is the right sort of diet and approach?
The dietary guidelines came out last week. That's probably what you're referring to. And I'm on the American College of Cardiology and Nutrition Committee. U.S. News and World Report came out with its diet rankings a few days ago. And what was nice, they rated the, quote, Ornish diet as number one for heart health for the sixth year in a row, which is nice. The fact is that it's really not that hard. I wrote an article for Time Magazine a few years ago, and I said, look, once you get past all the stuff, and I participated in this conference last month in Boston that David Katz from Yale and Walter Willett from Harvard put together to try to say, what is the common ground here? And I think what most people agree on is that an optimal diet is, to the degree you can eat a whole foods plant-based diet, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, soy products in their natural unrefined forms, and also low in refined carbs, sugar, white flour, things like that. It's not this or that. It's really both. And avoid the processed foods and to get things as close as possible as you can into their natural state. That's really an optimal way of eating. And we found in all of our studies that the more people change, the more they improved at any age, which I thought the younger people with less severe disease would do better, but it turned out it wasn't how old or how sick they were. It was simply a function of how much they changed. So whether you're trying to educate people in a digital way or in a bricks and mortar way or both, I think this is really where everything comes together. And if you want, we can talk about what we've learned about what enables people to make these kinds of changes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, when you said whole foods, I immediately thought of whole foods, which is where I spend about 90% of my salary. And it got me thinking, you know, what about these low-income populations who are struggling to access the really high-quality food that you just mentioned? What are the right interventions for them?
Well, back in 1999, I worked with the CEO of McDonald's to get salads on the menu. I figure they've got 43 million customers. These are generally lower income people. Let's make it easier for people to eat healthy. So they did. But that was the good news. The bad news is that because of these perverse subsidies, I mean, the diet that is really the optimal way to eat is essentially a third world diet. It's, you know, this is the way people ate before they started eating a lot of meat and fat and things that they, you know, because they were more expensive. So at the McDonald's, the salad was $5.95, the burger's 99 cents, so you get more calories for your dollar by eating junk food because it's subsidized, and it doesn't really price into the real cost of society, which is a whole secondary issue. But in fact, you know, fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes and soy products is a third world diet. It's not, I mean, it's the more expensive foods like the meats and pastries and so on are the ones that we're trying to reduce. It actually costs less to eat this way. And particularly if you buy it in bulk or you do it with the food co-op or things like that. Mark Bittman wrote a column about this a few years ago, that it's actually less expensive to eat this way. The problem is that if you live in the poorer parts of town, you have food deserts. You can't even get anything except fast food. That's why I tried to work with McDonald's to get them to make healthier foods. Just, you know, if you have 43 million customers, even incremental change on that scale is worth doing.
So I may have you to thank for the chicken Caesar at McDonald's in the airport.
You do, actually. We also got them to take the trans fats out of their french fries to reduce the sodium content. You know, they didn't tell anybody about that because they were afraid that people wouldn't, you know, if it's healthy, that it's somehow, you know, all these false choices. You know, is it fun? When I chaired PepsiCo's health advisory board for 5 years when Steve Reinemann and then Indra Nooyi came in, and they said, for their first day, they said, these are our fun-for-you foods and these are our good-for-you foods. And I said, well, that's the whole problem right there. You know, we have this idea that it can't be both. Why can't it be fun for you to look good and feel good and have better sex and lose weight and look younger and all those kinds of things? And, you know, this, you know, the old joke, am I going to live longer? Is it going to seem longer if I eat and live healthily? This idea that it's a false choice. You can do both. And I think that if you look in the, I mean, many of you are in the investment world. I mean, the hottest thing that's going now are healthy foods, making it easy for people to eat healthy foods. You know, Mark Bittman left the New York Times. It's an incredible job to work with Purple Carrot. But there's so many things out there now. This is really where the parade is going. As the population is aging, as people are realizing that drugs and surgery don't work that well, and that diet and lifestyle do, anything in this space is going to do well if you do it properly.
So one of the buzzwords for this conference is reducing readmissions. I've probably heard it like 1,000 times in 2 days. But a lot of these health systems, you know, the dirty secret is that they still do make money from admissions. That's part of the business model.
Yeah.
So how are we going to get these sort of preventative programs, a lot of these amazing digital health tools that can assist with preventative care and wellness? How are we going to get them into a system that just isn't aligned financially?
Well, the system is becoming more aligned as we change. As you know, it's going to take a few years for Obamacare to kick in. But as we move into more bundled payments as opposed to fee for service, then keeping people out of the hospital makes more money than admitting them. And it turns out, you know, my guiding principle for the almost 40 years I've been doing this work, I'm 96. I look pretty good, don't you? No, just kidding. I'm 60. Well, I'm almost 62. Is that if you can treat the underlying cause, then your body has a remarkable capacity to begin healing. Highmark found that they reduce readmissions by almost 90% when people, you know, made big enough changes in diet and lifestyle. And so, but what we've learned that what enables people to make these changes is not the way I was trained. I was trained as a doctor to try to scare people into changing. You know, and if you could just scare people enough, then you can get them to change. I mean, you're from London. You know, if you go into Heathrow and you go through the duty-free shops there, you see these big cartons of cigarettes with, you know, people half their faces removed and tracheotomies and smoking kills in big letters. And like, if we can just scare people enough, then they won't smoke. But information, and this is really important because so much of digital health is based on, if we can just get information to people, that'll do it. But of course, everyone who smokes knows it's not good for you. It's not like you tell somebody, hey, did you know smoking's bad for you? They go, I didn't know that. I'll quit today, you know? So information is important, but it's not usually sufficient. And fear is a great motivator for like 4 to 6 weeks. If someone's had a heart attack or they've been to the emergency room, they'll do pretty much anything that their doctor tells them for like a month or two, and then they stop doing it because fear is not a sustainable motivator. And that's true in politics as well. It grabs you viscerally, but it's not sustainable. What's sustainable is love and pleasure and freedom and feeling good. And again, because these underlying biological mechanisms are so much more dynamic than we once realized, when people make big enough changes in their diet and lifestyle, whether they're sick or not, but especially if they're sick, they feel so much better so quickly, it reframes the reason for making these choices from fear to joy. I mean, what's the mortality rate in this room? Does anyone know? 100%.
I don't know,
right?
If I want to know.
It's 100%. It's one per person. We're all going to die. It's not something that we think about most of the time because it's too scary. And so, if you know, for about 4 to 6 weeks, the denial gets broken down when someone's been admitted. But if that's all you've got, the denial comes back and people tune out. You know, half to two-thirds of people prescribed statins like Lipitor are not taking them after just 6 months because they're fear-based. Take this pill. It's not going to make you feel better to prevent something really awful like a heart attack or stroke years down the road that you don't want to think about, so people stop thinking about it. But when you change your diet and lifestyle, you feel so much better so quickly. Your brain gets more blood. You think more clearly. Your skin gets more blood. Your heart gets more blood. Your sexual organs get more blood. Everything gets better. And you feel. And so for many people, it's like you connect the dots between what you do and how you feel. It's like, oh, when I do this, I don't feel so good. When I do this, I feel good. So maybe I'll do more of this and less of that. And then if you can get people to love and support, then that's really what makes it sustainable.
And speaking of things you do for 4 to 6 weeks, do you have a Fitbit?
Do I have a Fitbit? I had a, Mark Benioff gave me a Fitbit years ago, and I used it for a while. And again, I find that the information is motivating up to a point, but it's not really sustainable. I think what really makes it sustainable is the fact that I've got a 6-year-old girl, I've got a 15-year-old son, I have a wonderful wife. I want to be as healthy as I can to walk them down the aisle one day and live as long as I can for pleasure, not out of fear, though.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ornish. So refreshing. Thank you.